This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the business end of the Champions League and some things you already knew. Riyad Mahrez is bad at penalties, Lionel Messi is good, Kylian Mbappe is also good, Juventus are bad, Celtic just aren't quite good enough. Not a vintage night of football, but we'll guide you through it. Another win for Graham Potter, whose excellent start continues, rotating his team and getting results. There's an absolutely sensational miss to discuss. Could it be higher than 10 on the Rosenthal range? There's also a Gary O'Neill being really annoyed about the handball law. Some interesting stuff from Qatar for Philippe to get his teeth into, and a full report on Cambridge United ending a run of five straight defeats, which we didn't mention, with a flying win at Wickham. All that plus what is acceptable to have embroidered on your football boots, and how newsworthy is a story if the only person you can quote is me. We'll answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello.
I really hope they keep in the 5 seconds before then that mean nothing to people listening. Jonathan Faduba, welcome.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Philippe Auclair.
Bonjour.
Let's start in Group E. Just so you know, Philippe was a bit late. Jonathan has to go early. We've got another pod to do in a bit. I was really just taking the piss. Barry just said, get on with it in a rude way. Here we go. Group E. Chelsea are through as group winners on head-to-heads with Milan. Below them, AC Milan need to avoid defeat to Salzburg to go through. If Salzburg win, they are through. Zagreb need to beat Chelsea to have a chance of getting into the Europa League. Let's start with Chelsea's win away at Salzburg. Two lovely goals here, Jonathan. And I suppose the difference for Graham Potter between managing Brighton and managing Chelsea is you have players who can score goals, full stop. That's it. You have players who can score goals.
Yeah, of course. Besides looking more debonair, you also have players who can slap one in the top corner from 25 yards out, and you don't have to worry about expected goals. So that was nice. To be fair, he's done a fantastic job so far. They look so fluid, Chelsea, and I don't know if this is kind of maybe a confidence thing. He's just come in and, you know, stopped playing, for example, Loftus-Cheek as a wing back, and you know, just put people in the right positions and maybe given them a bit of positivity. But the way that they're actually playing and the intricacy of their passing has been really impressive, and also how they react to setbacks. You know, they went one all. It was really quite a good atmosphere against Chelsea, and you thought maybe they might wobble a little bit. He's rotated the squad slightly with Pulisic coming in and others, but they didn't really show any signs of kind of nerves, or, you know, they showed great resilience. So obviously, the level of the team is higher when you've got players like Kai Havertz. That was a brilliant strike, but yeah, nicer suits and also better players who can score goals.
It's interesting you say putting players in their sort of correct positions when you see sort of Sterling and Pulisic sort of playing wing back, Barry, which is not where I'd expect to see either of those players, but it kind of works.
Yeah, it did work. I mean, as Jonathan said, they are very fluid and there's lots of intricacy and players filling in for each other. And if you've got Pulisic and Sterling playing as wing-backs, you've then behind them got Trevoh Chalobah and Mark Cucurella either side of Thiago Silva, who can cover for them when they go forward. There's midfielders in cover. So people will have expected Chelsea to win that game, but It was Salzburg's first defeat at home, I think, in 41 games. So that's quite a record to put an end to. I thought Salzburg might get a result here, but Chelsea ran out 2-1 winners and should have won by a lot more. But Salzburg goalkeeper Philippe Cohn was probably man of the match. He made some tremendous saves, particularly from Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who wasn't his night. He was foiled by the keeper on quite a few occasions. And Jorginho had a header cleared off the line as well. So I think the score flattered Salzburg, and a good performance by a Chelsea team whose manager looks to the manor born.
And the only question, in fact, Max, is that
Would they have scored more goals with Cristiano Ronaldo on the pitch?
It's a wild rumour, that, isn't it? It can't be. I mean, it's just that insane. On Napoli, which both seem ridiculous.
The thing as well, I mean, Barry said to the manner born, but it's the gentle manner of it as well. It's the kind of naturalness of it all. The fact that Cucurella, who didn't have perhaps the best of starts to his Chelsea career, is finding, you know, is finding his feet, so to speak, which for a footballer is quite important. The fact that Trevor Chalobah now looks like somebody you think, oh, maybe he should actually be part of Gareth Southgate's squad for Qatar. Thiago Silva, who's, I don't know, he still doesn't age at all, was again very important yesterday. I don't know, things seem to happen in a kind of natural, normal way, which is totally not dramatic, whilst at the same time producing football that is very pleasing on the eye indeed. So Graham Potter might be a good manager, Max, I want to reveal on this pod. He might actually be quite good at what he does. Not just well-dressed, and he's very well-dressed.
I think you might have
you know,
a point.
He's, I think, what Nagelsmann is aiming at, but will not get.
Right. As in terms of just aesthetically or football-wise as well?
Who knows? Perhaps both. But sartorially, the kind of ease as well as the way he dresses, I don't know which kind of pop or rock school would you link his sartorial style to when it comes to Potter?
You think it's a pop star? It doesn't... No, I think it's...
If I were not nice to him, I would say Chris Martin. And I'm sorry, I apologise for that.
More Johnny Cash, surely.
Okay.
See, I quite like Coldplay. I quite like
of
Coldplay.
Of course you do. Right. I mean, of course you do.
Yeah, of course I do. What? I don't see what's wrong with that. I mean, I don't listen to them every minute of the day, but I don't... If it comes on the radio, I just tap along and have a nice time. I don't think, you know, I don't think it's an insult. But, you know, people can like different things. What do you mean, of course I do, Barry? What does that mean? I'm just so middle of the road. Is that what you mean? Yeah.
It's entirely in keeping with your vanilla personality.
The caveat, the only caveat would be the fact that there is one player who is not firing on all cylinders and seems to be going through a little bit, not a crisis, but a moment of lesser confidence is Aubameyang, who again was a bit hesitant in front of goal. I mean, when there's one particular chance where clearly his first touch, you could see he was thinking, oh shit, I'd better not miss that one. And he did. And that's perhaps the only thing that is slightly obscuring blue clouds over Chelsea.
That is
blue clouds. There's no such thing as blue clouds. Blue skies over Chelsea.
There can be if you want. That inner monologue is exactly my inner monologue in a one-on-one in 11-a-side football. Oh shit. Jonathan, it's interesting when we talk about, you know, it helps to have good players. And I wonder if that is sort of how we should analyse football more, a bit like that. You know, like when we're constantly talking about Ralf Hasenhüttl and is he good? And really, at the end of each game, you should just say, his players aren't as good as the opposition. And so it's not really fair to judge him. You know, it sort of seems like perhaps this is sort of shown the Achilles heel of everything that we're trying to do on a sort of almost daily basis.
Yeah, I read somewhere once that they should, I think it was a manager who was saying that you don't get kind of like the wage bill next to the league table, if you know what I mean. And if you had the price of every player or whatever, or the squad next to the table, it would make more context. I think it was a manager who was struggling and sort of trying to justify that, you know, I can't do it. You know, my hands are tied. I'm not sure anyone would really enjoy that.
Yeah. It wasn't Gaultier at PSG, was
no,
it? Let's face it.
It definitely wasn't Gaultier, but I think it might have been Sean Dyche. I don't know. I can't remember. But anyway, you're right. Good players do help you to do better. But I think the thing with, obviously going back to Chelsea, the thing that Graham Potter's done is a bit like Philippe just mentioned. They actually look really coherent. It doesn't kind of look like it almost looks as if they've had a pre-season since he's joined. And I remember when Tuchel joined, it was very similar. Like he immediately came in and managed to sort of implement his ideas like within a few weeks. And I think that's a sign of a really sort of good coach, like really clear on his ideas. Obviously, how long it will last will be seen. But you have to bear in mind, obviously, players, like top players, I suppose the one thing people would have been saying about Potter is, oh, well, he's never managed these big dressing room characters. And they might have been looking at him a little bit and saying, well, you know, what are you going to do with me? But he's managed to also integrate, you know, the players who maybe weren't getting as much game time, Conor Gallagher, Pulisic, like he sort of seems to have bonded with each player pretty much, more or less. So I think it's really remarkable to do that whilst we're in the middle of a season where there's games literally, you know, twice a week. So that is pretty, I think, does deserve commending, like how well he's adapted, considering he's never managed at that level before.
Yeah, some of the moves in the first half were beautiful, weren't they? And he is rotating a lot. Milan won 4-0 in Zagreb in the other game in this group. Philippe, Raphael, oh, a tea is just coming through the door. This is so wonderful to see. The
Room service, yes.
Milan won 4-0 in Zagreb. I mean, the only thing to say about this game, Philippe, is that Raphael Leao is just special. That goal where the opposition just kind of melted away was beautiful, wasn't it?
Yes, and there's a kind of, can I use the word almost nobility, as is elegance when he runs with the ball. It is absolutely wonderful. And I'm actually pinching myself and thinking, is it the same player who was at Lille? Is it the same player who was bought for €0, if I'm not mistaken? And the answer is yes. It's absolutely, yeah, absolutely marvellous to see that. And I think Portugal might have an alternative up front at the World Cup. No, he's been absolutely extraordinary. And I don't know if we can say much about the game itself, because to be honest, the opposition was not the strongest. And you could, if you were nitpicking, I suppose you could say that actually one of his goals, they were melting, but in a way he had pushed the ball too far. It was almost as if there was this kind of force field around him, and then they would go boom 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 on each side, and you know, when he was running alongside.
Yeah, I mean, I did think that it was a weird goal, because it looked like he didn't have the ball at any time, but it also looked like no defender could get anywhere near him to stop him. So I'm not sure what happened, but maybe just everybody just lost control of their senses.
Well, I think the acceleration is there, and talk about this moment when you are in doubt in front of goal. Well, he certainly didn't have that. There was a false ease on the eye as to the difficulty of what he actually achieved. It's absolutely major talent.
He is a major talent. You are correct. Group G, this group's done. City, Man City win the group. Dortmund are through in second. Sevilla into the Europa League. Goalless at Dortmund. The first time that Borussia Dortmund have failed to score at home since June 2020. So that is quite a long time. Ian says, Manchester City, penalties, how, why? Why is Riyad Mahrez still taking penalties? I think Man City have missed something like 25 in 80 or something extraordinary. Our mate Musa Okwonga from Stadio is saying, look, Riyad Mahrez is still taking penalties so City feels something. You know, it's the same reason a supervillain explains their evil plan to the hero before letting themselves be challenged to a duel. It does seem odd, Barry, that Pep doesn't seem to care about penalty taking when he cares about everything else to such a minute degree.
Well, I think he does care. I mean, the reason Riyad Mahrez took the penalty is because Erling Haaland had gone off at half time. I think he got a knock from a tackle from Emre Can, who also gave away the penalty, and he apparently had a fever. He's got goal fever, we know that, but he had a more debilitating fever.
Stop it.
It would be funny, actually, if that was the thing that stopped him. He's succumbed to goal fever and is lying in bed shivering, sweating. Yeah, so that's the reason Riyad Mahrez took the penalty. Maybe someone else should have taken it, because he's missed 10 out of 30, I think, in his career, which isn't a very good record. It was a good save, so Gregor Kobel deserves plenty of credit. It was a very good penalty save. I've seen far worse penalties go in. But, it didn't matter ultimately, because it was a result that suited both teams. But it is a weird one that could prove costly at some point further down the line.
Philippe, Mark Langdon was telling me yesterday that in the book Pep Confidential, right, he says he doesn't care who takes penalties. And that record of 25 in 80... right? 25 being missed out of 80. That is a lot of penalties being missed, isn't it?
That's way above the average, which would be about 71-72%, if you know. So are you good at mental arithmetics?
Not that good.
or do you have a calculator at hand? And but it's basically worse than the average, and which is absolutely extraordinary considering the technical level. And you would think, well, penalty taking should be a technical exercise, should surely? Well, clearly it isn't, because if that were the case, I mean, there would be no, he doesn't have a Giroud. You saw the Giroud penalty. That was completely unstoppable. And you've got the percentage now, Max. I see this expression on your face.
So I think it works out that Man City have scored 69% of their penalties, whereas penalties...
Well, you say hang on.
Penalties are scored 85% of the time. So that is quite a lot.
Okay, so I was thinking of Leo Messi's penalty percentage, which is very low as well. So Messi is low, and so is Manchester City. So obviously being... not very good at penalty kicks is actually very good for you. we've got a new theory here.
Joe says, how is Emre Can only 28 years old? Which is a really brilliant question. Well, that's what he said. Again, you know, I don't mean to do frantic research during a pod, but yeah, apparently Emre Can is 28 years old. I mean, that is a stunt. I had him at least 35. Absolutely astonishing. I mean, he still looks quite young, but when he gave the penalty away, Barry, I just thought, well, he's old and slow, so it's kind of okay. Actually, should be peak year for Emre Can.
Mahrez tripped over his Zimmer frame.
Anyway, what else do we read into this, Jonathan? You know, City have drawn their last two Champions League games 0-0, but, you know, they had a man sent off against Copenhagen. They've won the group. They've done everything they need to do, right?
Yeah, there's not much to read into this game except don't let Riyad Mahrez take penalties in the future. I don't know how they continue to do it. Nearly cost them one, if not two titles, one at Anfield. Can't remember who won the league that year. I think did Liverpool win the league that year? They might have done. And also the West Ham one.
Is that the one when he booted it over?
Yeah, in the last minute at Anfield. Then obviously the one at West Ham Stadium where, you know, it was such a, you know, they managed to turn that round in the end, the last few minutes of the season, but that was a key penalty as well. So I think that was more or less the only conclusion for the match. Haaland went off at half time, maybe with a slight injury. There was some talk of him having a fever, some talk of him having a strain, but there wasn't much else to draw from this except that Jude Bellingham is one of the best talents I've seen probably ever.
I think everybody, it's a pity that nobody can see the smile on Jonathan's face when he talked about Jude Bellingham. I think a smile which is shared by absolutely everybody.
I can't get over how good he is. Like I just like at 19 to be playing the way he is in the Champions League and the level of maturity, like even when he speaks after the game, he talks like he's the captain and the leader of the club. And I think I said it on Twitter or whatever, but like the level of kind of maturity you need to be able to go to a foreign country, like, and you know, I think he's embraced the language. He's really well respected by his teammates. Like to be able to do that at 19 is, I think sometimes you don't even realize how impressive that is. But yeah, that's why the big smile on my face, Philippe. But I just think he's a fantastic like player, and you know, as a person, he seems like a nice guy as well.
Where do you think he'll go? Do you think he'll go this summer? I mean, I can't remember what his contract situation is, and where do you think he'll go?
He's under contract until June 2025, so I think people will start. And I was looking at what our friends from Transfer Market was putting at his value. They were putting 81 million. I think you can multiply that by two, perhaps.
Well, obviously add a World Cup winner's medal, which he'll certainly
have. Of course.
Christmas.
That goes without saying.
You're absolutely right.
I was going to say one thing about this game, and I know Barry thinks it's not a very interesting thing to say, but it struck me because when the, you know, UEFA gives the team sheets and they give you a tactical team sheet, and the tactical team sheet
is always
that
wrong.
They gave, but
it's always wrong.
It bore no resemblance whatsoever. I said Dortmund's back three was actually a back four because Thorgan Hazard was playing as a fullback, and the back four of Manchester City was a 2-3-5 because John Stones was playing either as a third centre back or as an additional midfielder, and it was at some stage, especially when you watch this on television and you don't have a full picture of the pitch, you're wondering, what on earth is going on here? And yes, so it was just a remark en passant that the way we describe games, you know, 4-4-1-1, whatever, is perhaps a little bit old-fashioned, and we have to think of perhaps better ways of explaining what we see on the pitch.
That's a very good point. I imagine it's true. Like sometimes when we're doing the coverage over here, and then they say, and let's have a look at the lineup, the Man United lineup, and you're looking at it, it just comes up with like a formation going, well, he's not playing there, and he's not playing there, and he's not playing there. So I don't know why we've done that. Anyway, also in that group, Sevilla beat Copenhagen 3-0. Sevilla have confirmed European football. Very lucky, you think, Philippe?
I think they were really flattered by the scoreline. Copenhagen actually put a team that was much younger than normal because of their situation in the group. There's nothing they could hope for. So they thought, okay, let's give the youngsters a chance. They did extremely well, front of pretty big travelling support, by the way. And Sevilla really, really, really struggled for a lot of the time. And to be honest, the Danes should have opened the scoring. And it's only because Isco scored an absolute peach of a curler in the top corner. And they scored also very late on that. You've got this scoreline thinking, it was just a normal night at the office. It wasn't. Copenhagen really did well, and Sevilla struggled far more than the scoreline indicates.
And six teenagers, the most number of teenagers ever starting in a Champions League game for Copenhagen. So there you go. Right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with Celtic out of Europe. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Jacob says, if we buy a ticket to the live show, do we get to meet the elusive Lars Silverton? And this is because Mrs. Rushton recorded a video to try and sell some tickets, and she knew everybody's name. She didn't quite get Lars's correctly, but you know, I thought she did an excellent job, and I'm happy to use her for more marketing things. Purposes, whatever the word is, as long as it's not an abuse of my power. You did mention, Barry, that she said she'd be babysitting, and you pointed out that if it's your own child, it isn't babysitting.
No, it's parenting. If I was looking after him, it would be babysitting.
It's a very good point. 17th of November, me, Barry, Lars Silverton and Ellis James, go to theguardian.com/guardianlive. We're streaming it around the world as well. We'd love you to join us wherever you are. We very much enjoy getting those photos of people in Shanghai or Brisbane or New Delhi or wherever you are. So we'd like everybody who listens to come and watch it. Let's go to Group F. Real Madrid will win the group if they beat Celtic in their final game. RB Leipzig can overtake them if they beat Shakhtar, and Real don't win, but a win for Shakhtar takes them into the knockout at Leipzig's expense because of their head-to-head record. Celtic are out. And that, Barry, for Shakhtar to still be in a position to get through to the group stages is such a great achievement, isn't it?
That's an incredible achievement, considering their team is largely comprised of youth academy graduates. And I suppose in Mikhailo Mudryk, they have arguably the player of the tournament so far. He is just incredible. The goal he scored last night was fantastic. Took on Juranovic and rifled the ball past Joe Hart into the roof of the net. And then set up what should have been the winner, only for his pal, who I'm reluctant to name and shame, Danilo Sican, I think is his name. Who
didn't seem that reluctant.
The ball was on a plate for him after brilliant work by Mudryk to get the better of Cameron Carter-Vickers, galloped down the inside left, squares the ball, and Sican somehow missed an open goal from 8 yards.
He didn't go, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit. He went, oh shit. And that was that.
Do you think he was trying to control the ball, Philippe?
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
I think he was trying to take a touch and then, you know, make sure. And his touch was too heavy and took the ball wide. But, oh, my God.
It was so desperate. And he looked so young that you didn't want to, like, you know, he's older than Jude Bellingham. So it's okay. We can laugh. But what a moment for him. And he looked sort of crestfallen. You could see for, like, the next few minutes sort of had his head in his hands. It didn't actually matter, right? It didn't matter for the final scoreline. It didn't matter for what Shakhtar have to do. but it was some miss. Yeah, and Mudryk, you're right. I mean, he's a fantastic player. I don't know if you've had, as I presume you have with all players, had your eye on him for about 25 years. This guy's so good. And they rejected 26 million in the summer for him, and I suspect they'll get a whole lot more for him.
Yeah, I agree that with Barry's comment, he's been one of the players of the tournament, maybe along with Kvaratskhelia at Napoli. Just the things he's doing are kind of breathtaking at the moment. Operates on the left and tends to sort of cut inside rather than maybe go on the outside, as a lot of wingers do these days. Just so good, kind of, especially in counter-attacking transitions, which has become like a massive part of football now. And some of the goals he's scoring, you know, like the cheek of it almost, you know, to be hitting it from there and sort of very little backlift. He doesn't need much space or time to hit it. And I think that shows a lot of bravery when you're sort of 21, playing in the Champions League. You know, you've not been at that level too often to take those kind of shots on. You know, does take an element of bravery, let alone sort of executing it. So, yeah, he's there's a lot of people already watching him and scouts and that kind of thing. But I think for Shakhtar, also securing the Europa League is an achievement in itself, as you mentioned there before, Max, you know, just to even be in this position, considering everything that's going on, and to get out of the group with European football to tarry on next year is a really commendable achievement from everyone, Mudryk included.
Barry, any reasons for optimism for Celtic? You know, in all these games, they've competed at times. You know, they came out of the blocks against Real Madrid for the first like half an hour, you know, hit the post. In fact, this goal in this game was probably the only bit of luck they've actually had in the entire run.
Yeah, the ball broke towards G. Marcus and he kind of hooked it into the corner. I would say C plus, must try harder. They weren't terrible, but there is an awful lot of room for improvement. But with better finishing, things could have panned out differently for them. But I think they should have done better.
With better players, it's the Graham Potter scenario.
Well, no, I think the players they have are capable of better, and showed they are capable of better. But just errant finishing and players who can spank the ball home for fun in the SPL or the Scottish Premiership, not quite cutting the mustard on this more elite stage when, you know, they are similar kind of chances. So, yeah, I'd say Ange Postecoglou, he looked pretty forlorn after the game, but said, you know, to improve in the Champions League, we need to keep being in the Champions League. And if they go on to win the title, they will be in the Champions League next season. So,
yeah, I think you're right. Furuhashi hasn't, because over the last year or so, sort of every time I've watched Celtic highlights, it's just him scoring goals and just loads of them. But it hasn't really worked for him in the Champions League this season. Also in this group, Real Madrid lost to RB Leipzig. Adam says, with Madrid losing a group game, who do you think will score in the final for them? Yeah, it's obviously going to happen, is it? And actually 3-2, Jonathan, probably flattered Real Madrid a bit, didn't it?
Yeah, it did a bit. And first game they've lost since May. I think that's 30 games unbeaten, Real Madrid. So not often that Carlo Ancelotti has faced defeat in recent months. Obviously, already through, so maybe, you know, the motivation dropped a couple of percent, which at this level of European football probably makes a bit of a difference. But obviously, you know, you've got Timo Werner getting on the score sheet again, so he does seem to like scoring against Real Madrid. But yeah, no, it was, I suppose, one of those games that's not quite a dead rubber, but it didn't mean that much for Real Madrid.
I mean, Timo Werner, by the way, the run for, I absolutely loved the run and the acceleration for his goal. It's exactly the kind of run and acceleration he didn't do at Chelsea. There was a very clear say, this is how I've got to slightly put the brakes on and then full pelt, and cutting the trajectory of the ball absolutely perfectly. One little footnote to this game is that, which is about the World Cup and about the French midfield, is that the fact that, you know, France will be without N'Golo Kanté, might well be without Paul Pogba, so big problem in midfield, what do we do? And many people had said, some people had said, well, maybe we could go all Real Madrid here. Mm-hmm. Tchouaméni Camavinga. On the strength of that particular game, I don't think Didier Deschamps' mind would have been...
Oh, really?
Yes.
They're such good players, aren't they?
It's still not quite happening. But it will happen at some point, you know, give them plenty of time.
Yeah, I think just wanted to, you mentioned players that to keep an eye on, that kind of thing. Mohamed Simakan, formerly at Strasbourg, Philippe. So you may know about him more than me, but yeah, he's the right back for Leipzig. Basically, he's a player to look out for. He's been incredible this season. He made one sort of lung busting run, Reece James style, down the wing. I think he's a top player. I've watched him a few times in the Champions League this season. Probably one to look out for sure. I'm not sure if he might even make the French squad, but he's one to keep an eye on. 22 years old.
Noted. Luka Modric, one to watch, not playing. So they did rest. a couple of players. Real Madrid's Group H. Both PSG and Benfica are through. They've both got 11 points. Juve and Maccabi Haifa are both on 3 points. So first and second in the Europa League spots up for grabs in the final group game. Let's start with Juventus. Another defeat. Callum says, should there be a mini European Super League next summer for all the small clubs that have knocked out Juventus in the past 5 years? Colin Miller, the journalist, writing, Ajax, Lyon, Porto, Villarreal and Benfica. Five clubs deemed not glamorous enough for the European Super League by one of its key cheerleaders, Juve chairman Andre Agnelli. Sometimes football can be funny. Neil says, can we just have an hour-long pod of Philippe laughing at Agnelli and Juve? There we are. They were bad again, like 4-3.
Well,
4-3.
They were bad until the moment where I don't know what it was. What kind of reaction was it? Pride? Was it they somehow deep in their collective memory, they remembered that they had some decent players and could play a bit of football? Was it the fact that Benfica couldn't quite believe that we're leading 4-1, it could be 6-1?
I think it was because they brought a load of young lads with no fear off the bench.
Samuel Erling Jr., who was absolutely splendid and who deserves a very special mention, if only for this performance, but also the fact that he made a very, very powerful and difficult career choice. He's a Chelsea academy product and decided to, try his luck abroad. And my goodness. And he did that, I think, and Jonathan probably knows more than I do, but he did that at the time of COVID, which means he really had to cut all his links with his family and so forth and go and live there and find out by himself if he would be, strong enough to cut it. And the answer to that is an emphatic yes. He was absolutely magnificent when he came on. So, but they really were destroyed and there was nothing. I mean, Benfica were incredibly pleasing on the eye. Rafa Silva looked like he very often does, like €1 million, €10 million. He looked actually like €50 million on that particular night. They were simply terrific. But obviously, all the talk is about Juve and what on earth has happened and how long Allegri can possibly stay in place. And how long it will take for Thomas Tuchel to learn Italian. I mean, basically, that's what the dialogue is. And on the strength of that particular game, they do need something to happen in very, very quickly. But it's still very, very funny.
Allegri said, this elimination is not a failure. These things happen in football. I mean it feels like a failure. You're stroking your chin, Jonathan, like a sort of like a Bond villain. It is a failure for Juventus, isn't it? They've been absolute garbage in this Champions League.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for the. I just remember the Tuchel pod where we had to re-record because he was sacked during the record. I'm just keeping an eye on Twitter in case because I took a look at Gazzetta, obviously the Italian sports newspaper, and they said his destiny is sealed. That was pretty much their quote. He will be leaving. Obviously, four defeats out of five in the Champions League, and yeah, it is quite sort of karma in a way of just the teams that are beating them that the club and certain people at the club have been so sneering of in the past few years, and the comments saying that nobody wants to watch these sort of small teams; they want to see big teams every week. Well, it's quite funny seeing Juventus getting a little bit of comeuppance, but yeah, there is an issue there. I think they're also. There's some issues that are being investigated, aren't they, as well, off the field for certain financial things. So it seems like not a very great time for Juventus as a club in general. But maybe there's some hope, as Barry mentioned, with the young players that came on. Sula came on, a 19-year-old. They had another 19-year-old come on, and Erling Jr. So see how it goes from here. But I don't think Allegri's got too much long left in charge.
Look, that Andre Silva volley, little sort of backheel flick, half volley was... utterly beautiful. I don't know if it's the goal of the night, because we'll get on to PSG Maccabi Haifa now. Cape Town Gooner says, Messi continues to play exceptional football. Till what age do you think he'll keep going? If you must, you can also talk about the narcissistic and petulant Portuguese chap, he says. But what do you reckon, Barry? I mean, Messi looks as good now as ever, doesn't he?
Yeah, and he's adapted his game to suit his advancing years, I suppose. He's a different player now to the one that used to make these scurrying runs through defences and spank the ball into the roof of the net or into the top corner. What age is he? 35?
He's older than Emre Can. That's all I know.
Okay, right. He's older than...
He will be 36 on my birthday.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to see him win a World Cup. I'd absolutely love to see him win a World Cup. And if he does that, then he can do whatever he wants. I think if I was him, I'd just retire on the spot.
Which of the curled goals was your favourite? You've got Messi's outside of the right foot, then you've got Mbappe's first, where he's literally, there's no backlift whatsoever, and then you've got the third, which is a nicer move.
I will always go for the outside of the foot.
Yeah, I think always. You're right. I think you're right. Even though it wasn't as in the corner as Mbappe's.
No, but that's the move. It's just perfection. It was just perfection. It's amazing the way we're talking about Messi, and we think about the way we were talking about him last year. And when everything seems to be going wrong for him, you felt he was getting injured quite regularly. He wasn't scoring as many goals. He looked really dejected at times on the pitch. And now the thing that we've talked about is the fact that with a new manager like Christophe Galtier, suddenly these guys are finding their feet again, and they're in danger of becoming decent and dangerous, despite all the insane amount of, excuse me, but of shit that is happening in the club. There is not one day when there are no new revelations about Nasser Al-Khelaifi, about the way the club works in the French media. Unfortunately, we cannot possibly repeat any of these allegations on The Guardian Football Weekly, because that would land us in dear trouble. But please have a look, because it's very, very funny. But it doesn't seem very funny and not so funny, but it doesn't seem to affect them at all. And the debate as in, oh, how are they getting on together? Can they play together? When one scores, the other one doesn't. Well, okay, it was only a more modest opponent, shall we say, but it was a real demonstration of what this trio can do last night.
I did like, Philippe, for the first time ever, warning people you're about to swear. I mean, I don't believe that is a consistent approach that you've taken on this podcast in the last few years. Jonathan, Mbappe wants to play off the left, and he did, and Neymar's gone into the middle. Does that mean they're all happy again?
Not necessarily. I think that it's always going to play out in some way. But I don't know Philippe's perspective, but I've been a sort of... I've been on the Galtier train for many years, like since going back to a boring personal story, but I used to work as an analyst in French football when he was at Saint-Étienne. And it's a long time ago now, but I've liked him and followed him ever since. And I've always been quite an advocate of Galtier. I think he's a brilliant manager. And there was one time he was linked with the Everton job and it never came up, but I thought he would have been a good appointment. I just wondered what Philippe thinks about him, because obviously you're closer to it there. But
oh, I'm a fan. I'm a fan, and I'm like you. I've been talking about him for a long time. And in fact, I think I remember talking about possible managers for PSG and thinking about Christophe Galtier. With Saint-Etienne, with Nice, with Lille, with everybody. I mean, he's achieved absolutely remarkable things. And former very good player himself, by the way. But he's not somebody who overcomplicates things in tactical terms. He's more of a leader as well. He's very, obviously, he's got tactical nous, and he's very good at what we call coaching in French, which is basically in-game management. He's very good at that. He's also very good at building teams, which he has shown in every single club he's been in. He's more of a, if I were to compare him, even though their characters are quite different, because he can be quite stern at times, Galtier, I would say he's more in the kind of Ancelotti kind of type of manager. So a very safe pair of hands, but incredible capacity of putting players onside and making them, you know, offer something which is, to be honest, absolutely superb. And he's managing it with PSG. So be afraid, Max. Be very afraid.
Because one of the things that I've been impressed with him at PSG is just the way he's sort of got the buy-in from the likes of Neymar, who's doing a little bit more running, which where Pochettino tended to struggle a little bit last season. There was more sort of tantrums and things like that. Like Galtier, although he's not a huge name in world football, he's very good at getting people to buy into his ideas. And he seems to have done that even with the likes of sort of certainly Messi and Neymar. Mbappe is a little bit more, I think, work to do, I suppose, but he's got the buy-in from them in terms of how, yeah, where, in terms of how they play and the positioning they take and the interchanging of the positions. He's doing something quite well there, I think. And one other thing I just wanted to say on PSG is I think Hakimi and I think the fullbacks need a lot of credit. Nuno Mendes and Hakimi. I know we talk about Messi, Mbappe, and Neymar a lot, but I really think Hakimi's having a great season in the Champions League. And Nuno Mendes, the left back as well, is a good signing, in my opinion.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll look back at Monday Night Football and round up any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Vote for us in the Football Supporters Association podcast of the year. Go to the fsa.org.uk, because if we don't win, Barry, you won't be able to go up on stage and collect the award. And it's something that you like to do on an annual basis, isn't it?
I mean, I'd get over it. I'm quite happy just to go along and have a nice meal and a couple of glasses of wine. They always lay on a nice spread. But getting to go on stage and collect silverware and then bring it home on the tube is quite nice.
Okay, there we go. The fsa.org.uk. You can vote for The Guardian, for Robin Cowan, for David Squires, Barney Ronay, Susie Rack, for our radio show as well, if you would like to. On Monday, West Ham beat Bournemouth 2-0. Ian says, West Ham's last five home goals have been debatable and referee assisted. Does this mean we are now a big club? Jack says, what is a handball? Have we all been gaslit for years? Gary O'Neill was very upset, Barry, wasn't it? Lots of walking up to the referee going, it's all right, lads, I've got this, and then going on a tirade and just doing a lot of pointing. But I guess for Gary O'Neill, right, you know, he doesn't know if he's going to get this job, and these decisions could make a difference. I can't tell you if any of them are right or wrong.
The first thing I'd say is I think whether or not Gary O'Neill gets this job or not, he's already shown enough to get another job. Possibly not as good a job, but I think Gary will be all right. As far as the handball is concerned, it seems utterly absurd that the first one wasn't given. But having heard accounts from various referees, even though it's like a volleyball...
it's a spike.
Well, it's not a spike. The spike's...
Oh, no, true.
It's teeing up the spike.
Isn't the spike that one?
Oh, okay, right. That one. Sorry, yeah. I thought the smash was the spike. I stand corrected, or sort of corrected. I don't think either of us are quite sure. Anyway, it seems absurd that isn't a handball, but according to a couple of referees I've heard from, talking on TV or the radio, they say it isn't a handball. And if that's the case, then the handball law is ridiculous, but we already knew that. So
So it's like if you don't make your body bigger but you catch the ball, not necessarily a handball. I don't know, Philippe.
I don't know what to say. The arms and the hands were in a natural position. It was crazy. It made no sense. When I looked at it, I thought, okay, no goal, carry on.
It's quite a natural
position.
Anyway,
I will refer
you. No. Hang on. They're a natural position if you're sort of carrying like a sort of heavy, like a bag of sand that has no handles.
Or a Guardian Football Weekly trophy if you're Barry.
Yeah.
In the tube.
You're right.
But I'm sorry, this is absolutely ridiculous. But I think we should all refer to a piece that was written by somebody who is taking part in this pod about not basically respecting referees and not questioning and reading the laws again.
Yes.
Is that right?
Well, in that piece, Max, I did write, I literally read the handball law. I read it to myself as I was writing the piece and said, I still don't know what it is. And a lot of people got angry about that particular bit of the article, which I thought was not a sensationalist, controversial thing to say. But, you know, we'll get onto controversial things you can say and getting yelled at in just a minute. But anyway, look, it's a West Ham probably deserved to win, didn't they? Bournemouth didn't do much, but even still, I mean, I don't know. I don't hate talking about the handball. I find it quite fun. But, you know, it just seems like IFAB are got into some sort of pickle. Unai Emery has left Villarreal for Aston Villa. Villa have paid his €6 million buyout. Caretaker Aaron Danks, not Banks, will take charge against Newcastle this weekend. Danks for the memories, he'll say, as he returns to his coaching role. That is a producer Joel Grove joke, if you liked it or didn't. So is this a good appointment, Jonathan?
Yes.
Okay.
I think yes.
Don't sound convinced.
It's quite... No, I'm not convinced, to be honest. Well, obviously, I know what Aston Villa are trying to do. They're trying to be a good football team, but I'm not entirely sure where they're trying to go with what they're doing, if that makes sense. Because they threw a lot behind that, the whole Gerrard project. And I think Emery is a vastly different manager in terms of philosophy, how he wants to play, like style of football. Long story short, yes, it is good because he is a good manager, but I'm not exactly sure what Aston Villa are trying to do. That's pretty much my reasoning.
Alex emails, dear Pod, Aston Villa have eventually found Steven Gerrard's successor in Unai Emery. Quite ironically, Gerrard was sacked only a few hours after Liz Truss stepped down, and Emery was appointed on the same day Rishi Sunak has become our new Prime Minister. Does that mean that Aston Villa's fortunes are inextricably entangled with the Tories' misfortunes? Can we now rest assured we won't get relegated until the next general election? Unless, can the Tories get relegated, he says. Also, now that Emery has been appointed by every European team containing the word Villa in their names, such as Sevilla, Villarreal, and of course Aston Villa, can the pod think of any other Villa side that might tempt Emery away from Birmingham? Should we fear the advances of Pelsol Villa FC? Endless love to the pod, he says. Yeah, lots of people pointing out that Emery has managed Villarreal, Sevilla, Aston Villa, and David Villa, which feels very important. Philippe, any thoughts on Emery going to Villa?
I'm like Jonathan. I think a very good appointment. He's an excellent coach, excellent manager. But again, yes, it's one of those projects, inverted commas, which was backed, by the way, by very, very significant investment. So you would have imagined that a lot of thought went into that. But I think it reached a point where they had no choice but to part ways with Gerrard. And if you look at who is available, well, who was a possibility, not available. I think there's another way, by the way, to look at that is to look at a manager who's been a European trophy winner, who comes to a club which is trying to stave off relegation. That says a lot about the power of the Premier League and not necessarily in a good way.
On the subject of Aston Villa, we were talking about the Big Five joke I messed up on Soccer AM many years ago. I'm indebted to Emmett, who wrote, "You welcomed Aston Villa to the Big Five while Martin O'Neill was at the helm. I still think about this Big Red Five more often than I should, at least once every 2 months." Chris wanted us to spend a few moments to recognise the magnificence of David Squire's latest cartoon. I mean, look, David's a wonderful bloke. He is an astonishingly brilliant cartoonist. And he said, "With a few simple drawings, knock me sideways," said Chris. And it was reflecting, Barry, on the vile chance that not the Man City fans singing, it was actually the Forest fans singing "Always the Victim" to Liverpool fans at the weekend.
Yeah, and we mentioned this, or I mentioned it, brought it up on the radio on Sunday, and our console lit up with chippy tweets from Forest fans claiming that the "Always the Victim" chant is not about Hillsborough, which I think is not true. I think it can be about Hillsborough without mentioning Hillsborough. And it clearly upsets relatives of people who were killed in the Hillsborough disaster and people who were affected by the Hillsborough disaster. And it's important to mention that quite a lot of Nottingham Forest fans were affected by the Hillsborough disaster because they were there. And but for the grace of God, they could have been in the Leppings Lane end rather than Liverpool supporters. Just don't sing about tragedies. There's no need for it. But such is the nature of football tribalism. We see it manifest itself in so many different ways. But yeah, Squire's absolutely nailed it. And if you haven't seen his cartoon, seek it out.
Do. Owen says, what are the panel's thoughts on Peter Tatchell's protest in Qatar? Obviously, the cause is very important. I worry for members of the public trying to recreate the protest during the World Cup without the security of being a celebrity in the UK. In a statement, Peter Tatchell said he was surrounded and interrogated by 9 officers who asked where I was from, who was helping me, where I was staying, and when I was leaving Qatar. He said officials also arrested his colleague who was filming the event. Philippe.
I should say that, Max, we've recorded actually just yesterday a long conversation about the situation of LGBTQI plus people in Qatar, be they Qatari or Qatari residents. And that one thing that all the participants in this podcast, which you will hear in a couple of weeks' time, something like that, were saying, myself included, was that people taking on the role of savior in Qatar would actually do something which is harmful to the people who live there and who will be there when the World Cup circus has moved, that the people I've been in touch with, myself, have consistently, from this community in Qatar, have consistently said, don't do it, and that Peter Tatchell is fully aware of that. I won't go further than that. It's an issue that we'll be talking at, you know, in greater length, as it deserves to be talked about in another podcast of the Guardian Football Weekly.
Finally, on a slightly different subject, Craig says, does Paul Mullen deserve to move to a bigger club, mainly just to show off his new boots? Wrexham have banned the striker, Cambridge legend Paul Mullen, from wearing his boots, which featured a blunt message directed at the Conservative Party. They said, excuse my language, to copy Philippe, fuck the Tories. The National League club described Mullen's fashion statement as an unwelcome distraction. The Guardian report quoted me, Barry. This is just shows the depths that no one was really talking about this story. I just sent a tweet saying I thought it was funny, and I got a lot. I mean, I just don't tweet. I said a lot of mentions. Seemed unnecessary.
But you didn't say it was funny. You said you respected him more for his that gesture than for anything he'd done at Cambridge United, all the goals
I did,
he scored.
Yes.
So, you know, be accurate, Max.
You're right, I should be accurate. Well, yes, well, okay. I agree with the sentiment.
Yeah, I think we all agree with the sentiment. But, I mean, I think the reason Wrexham moved so quickly was that the MP for Wrexham is a Tory, Sarah Atherton. She was elected in the last election after Wrexham had been a Labour stronghold for 80 years. I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds discussing this in a future episode of Welcome to Wrexham.
It has to be said that I believe they played Halifax last night in front of something like 10,000 people. And there was a chant going around the terraces, which actually was exactly what you think it would be.
Well, I did get some tweets from listeners to the pod who are Conservative supporters who weren't happy with it. I did say, look, I don't know. I mean, it's getting.
I would argue, Max, that Tories, whether they listen to the pod or not, deserve to be unhappy because loads of us are unhappy, and it's largely because of them and the party they support.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't want to put them off listening to the pod, but
no,
come on,
I don't understand how if you're the Home Secretary, you can resign and then 6 days later be appointed again. That seems not a long time to resign, doesn't it? Anyway, what do we know? It's not Talk Politics. It's not the Guardian Politics Weekly. That probably exists and you should listen to it.
One of producer Joel's, his other joke in the past 24 hours was on the WhatsApp, where we were talking about having an intervention after you went rogue. And he said, oh, football wokely.
Well, that's definitely us. We are the tofu eaters, aren't we? Anyway, thanks so much for listening, whatever your political affiliation. Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Christian Bates.
This is The Guardian.